Kurt Eichenwald, New York Times bestselling author of Conspiracy of Fools and The Informant, chronicles the 18 months following 9/11 and lays bare what he sees as the harrowing decisions, deceptions, and delusions that changed America and the world forever in his book, 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. Kurt Eichenwald is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. He previously worked as a reporter at the Times for more than 20 years. Again, the name of the book, 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars. Kurt Eichenwald, a great pleasure to have you on the program this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What led you to specifically look at these 500 days following 9/11?
Well, it's interesting. It wasn't actually my original decision. What I was planning to do was write a narrative reconstruction of terrorism policy in the Bush administration from 2001 to 2008. And I did a lot of reporting on that. And as the more I did, the more I came to realize that all of the events that mattered, all of the decisions, all of the major actions, the decisions that we're living with till this day all took place in the first 500 days. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that, you really needed a very strong portrayal of those 500 days to really understand what happened over the next 6 years and up till today.
Realizing you took an entire book to do this, how can you characterize these terror wars?
Well, they're far more than just going into Afghanistan and going into Iraq. You know, what we're talking about are the consequences of a vast array of policies. We're talking about, warrantless wiretapping. We're talking about secret prisons. We're talking about what's called rendition, where you take someone from one country and spirit them off to a prison, for being a suspected terrorist. You're talking about Guantanamo. You're talking about, the vast array of what was decided, and also the motivations of those decisions. Anthrax attacks actually played a very large role in decisions that were made relating to Al-Qaeda. And so there was an interplay here that people didn't realize. And there's also, there were a lot of things that happened, both good and bad, that people are only now going to be finding out about by reading 500 Days.
You would think in reading this book, it was, I found it interesting of how you characterize the President of the United States in the sense of how administration officials would often intentionally keep President Bush in the dark.
There were instances where that happened. The biggest one was on what they called enhanced interrogation, what others called torture. And that policy was being put together at a meeting in the basement of the White House. And Alberto Gonzalez goes upstairs for a meeting with Bush. And Bush says, what's going on downstairs? And Gonzalez's response is, well, Mr. President, for your protection, I don't think you know need to know what's going on here. Now, eventually, once the policy was set, Bush was brought in because, he had to give an approval of it. But it is sort of interesting. It is very interesting that, the path of from the beginning to the policy, the president wasn't part of it.
With that said, during these 500 days, as far as the United States is concerned, how hands-on was the president?
It depends on the issue. Some of the things he was very strongly involved in, some of the things he was not. There was this war council that was created of, very small number of people, Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, Rumsfeld. And, policy was emanating from that group. Now, one problem was that not all members of that group were talking with every other member of that group. So, in the end, you had sometimes contradictory policies emerging and sometimes information, not being conveyed in ways that were completely honest. I mean, that, you know, Colin Powell's presentation to the UN about Iraq is very famous for having been very strong and very wrong. And, you know, Powell was depending on information that was coming from essentially other members of the War Council. And they had an outcome they wanted, and so they lied to Colin Powell, who in turn went and unknowingly repeated those lies to the United Nations. You know, and that's the kind of thing that you know, you were dealing with. I mean, the British had their own intelligence that they were gathering from inside the United States about the actions of the Bush administration. And there were intelligence people in Britain who were telling Prime Minister Tony Blair that, you know, Bush has been cut out. If you talk to Bush and if you talk to Rice, they might not know what's going on. And Rumsfeld knows what's going on, but he's not telling other people. And that sort of underscored the nature of the problem, that too many people had their own agendas that were going on here.
You spoke a moment ago about Colin Powell at the United Nations. You write in this book about President Bush's critical speech at the United Nations. The wrong speech was loaded into the teleprompter.
The wrong speech was in the teleprompter. It was. I think that was one of the most amusing things I came across. There was this back and forth in the administration and in negotiations with the British about whether Bush would endorse the adoption of one resolution by the UN or of a two-step resolution, essentially two resolutions, that would create a better opportunity for there not to be a war, or whether there would be a resolution at all. Cheney and company said there's no need for a resolution. Blair's position was we need two resolutions. Bush came out saying we need a resolution. And so there were lots of different speeches. He got up to give the speech at the UN, and everything was going along fine until he reached the point where it was supposed to be, so we will back a resolution. And the line wasn't there because it was the Cheney version of the speech. And so Bush winged it. He ad-libbed. And while he was ad-libbing, it might seem a very minor point, he said, we will back resolutions, plural, rather than resolution. Well, that was Blair's position that Bush had knocked down. So suddenly the British are going, oh, my God, Blair, you know, Bush now agrees with us. We're going to have two resolutions. So calls had to go out. They went out from Condoleezza Rice saying, no, we misstated. Bush was ad-libbing. It was a mistake. It's only one resolution. So it was very funny. I mean, you start off with something as minor as loading the wrong speech into the teleprompter, and you end up with a declaration of national policy that's wrong.
Meanwhile, you also write about Prime Minister Tony Blair allowing the president to believe that the British would join the attack in Iraq. Meanwhile, his own attorney general has declared the invasion without UN backing to be illegal.
Right. You know, Blair was in a very tough position because he had originally told the Americans that, you know, the Brits were on board. And then Attorney General Goldsmith, his attorney general, comes back and says, no, this war is illegal. If you don't get the UN to sign on. And by that point, the UN had not signed on to a specific declaration of war, never did. Declaration of war isn't the right statement, but, you know, essentially authorizing the use of force against Saddam. And so once Goldsmith told him it was illegal, well, Blair could not proceed with joining in the campaign so long as Goldsmith maintained that position. The thing to have done, of course, would be to go to George Bush and say, hey, we have this problem. We're working on it, but you need to be aware this is a big problem. Instead, Blair decided not to say anything and started putting pressure on Goldsmith to reverse his decision. And it was funny, Goldsmith basically took a two-step reversal. He said, maybe. You know, his first version was no. His second version was maybe. And then Blair put even more pressure on him, and finally he turned around and said, okay, it's legal. But that was, you know, literally days before the Iraqi invasion, and you know, we were planning to go in without knowing that our largest ally might not be joining us.
You write in the introduction of the book, readers looking in these pages for my view on these events will no doubt be disappointed. I have little faith in opinion, even my own. Instead, this book is meant to be a dispassionate history of this critical time. But given just the few points that you outlined with us this morning, through the process of your research, you had to have raised your eyebrows and furrowed your brow more than a few times.
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, in going through this, I come up with my own reactions to the facts I'm putting in there. And, you know, my reactions may or may not be, you know, people will read the book and may think I'm saying, you know, this is good or this is bad, and I'm actually saying nothing. I'm just saying here is what happened. And I think as a book, that's what's really important. You know, I do believe that it's important what I found, that, you know, everybody has an opinion, but not everybody has facts. And so what I've done is create something that is a narrative and just relays what I know. And at the end of the book, people can make their own. Once they know everything I know, they can make their own decisions. They don't need me telling them here's what it means, because my decision on what it means may be very different from someone else's decision about what it means.
The name of the book is 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars. It is published by Touchstone. Kurt Eichenwald, I thank you very much for spending time with us this morning. Best of luck. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
A great pleasure. Again, the name of the book, 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars. It is published by Touchstone, a division of Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.